So it's one thing to talk about how we read today, but can we ever know how people used to read, like 500 years ago? Did Shakespeare curl up with a book at night? Did Jane Austen or Frederick Douglass read for fun? Historian Anthony Grafton is kind of obsessed with the question of how people used to read as a way of getting a glimpse of the past. Years ago, when he was a grad student at Cambridge, he began paying attention to what our ancestors wrote in the margins of their books. He recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson about the history of reading.
It turned out that in the 16th and 17th century, reading was a very active process. And I guess I might compare it to the way a lot of us read on a computer now. But you read pen in hand, ready to react, to write yourself into the margin of the book in all kinds of ways. It's a very tactile thing. From the age of manuscripts, it was common for readers to draw elegant little hands in the margin at the points that interested them, as if they were talking about the touch experience of reading. And the point that you touch is also the point that touches you.
I have to tell you that I still, when I read, I usually underline, although I tend not to actually write in the books.
Yeah, I don't write in books either, but I underline and bend pages over, I'm ashamed to admit. But Isaac Newton did that. So I began to realize that there was another way of reading and that people were responding to books. They were telling me things about their own lives, as if a book was a kind of margins of a book were a kind of autobiography.
So can you give me an example of this? I mean, what have you learned about some writer or a reading experience by looking at all of these notes that have been written in books?
Sure. Here's one of my favorite examples. Henry Cornelius Agrippa was a magician, and he wrote the One Occult Philosophy, which is the standard Renaissance handbook of magic. And for decades, generations, historians have assumed that insofar as he tells you that magic recipes or methods work, he's a charlatan. So at one point in this book, he says, "So I'm going to tell you how you can project a message on the face of the moon. You write the message in blood on a mirror at the time of the full moon, and then it will appear on the moon." And I thought, okay, that's ridiculous. But I happened to find a copy that belonged to a very serious reader who writes at that point, "Yes, I saw this done in 1552. And that comment stuck with me. And a couple of years after I read it, I met a perceptual psychologist. And I said, "Can you give me any help with this? I have this guy who says he can do a bat signal in the Renaissance. And I have somebody else who says, yeah, I saw the bat signal. I saw this projected." And he explained exactly how it's done. Red is the color that leaves residue the longest in your eye. When you see red, it'll stay longer than any other color. And the other part of this, my perceptual psychologist friend was also an amateur magician. He said, "I'll tell you exactly how it was done. You're in a pre-modern world, so it's really dark at night. You go out on the full moon." He says it's full moon. Full moon's going to be incredibly bright, much brighter than we can now imagine.
Because there were no lights.
Because there are no lights, so there's no contrast with it. And I had actually visited my daughter in the Peace Corps in Africa, so I knew exactly what he meant because her village wasn't electrified. I'd even seen this. And he said, "So you write a message on the mirror with the light of the moon illuminating it. You write it in red and you get people to look and then you snatch it away and say, 'Look at the moon, it's there.' They're going to see it on the moon."
Wow.
It's a magic trick, but it's a real story. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, Henry Cornelius Agrippa is a very amiable kind of guy. One of the things I really liked about him was he hated the persecution of witches, and he actually intervened to save witches who were on trial. And I'd always wondered why he told these fibs, and the answer is he wasn't telling fibs. He was a conjurer, but not a charlatan.
Hmm. Well, I mean, what you're also suggesting is that centuries ago, I mean, we're talking what century?
This is the 1530s.
1530s. Maybe reading was a more powerful experience than it is now. I mean, people sort of took what they were reading to almost literal levels.
Oh, they really did. Machiavelli, a realist if ever there was, has a wonderful letter to a friend in which he talks about how he read books preparing to write his Prince and Discourses, his two great works in political theory. And he talks about going to the bar and playing cards with his neighbors and yelling and being stupid. Then he says, "And I come home. And I wash, and I put on my golden robes, and the great men of antiquity come to me, and I ask them questions, and in their humanity they answer me." So this is a vision of reading like a Renaissance court dance. It's ceremonious, it's elegant, it's beautiful, but it's also very intense and it has to be done right. So yes, reading had the keys to the knowledge that people most wanted. In the late 16th century, for example, people begin to read obsessively the Roman historian Tacitus, who's the great realist historian of the Roman Empire, the one who tells you the black secrets of empire. And they read Tacitus. It's like Edward Snowden putting things out on the web. This is a revelation. This is how things really work. Only the revelation now comes from digital media and then just came from books that hadn't been read or studied in the same way.
Well, and I would think that if people were reading sacred texts like the Bible, the stakes would even be higher.
And there you really see something different. I think that it's very clear to me that in the 16th and 17th centuries, people reading the Bible thought the book was moving them, not they moving the book. Nowadays,
because God was speaking directly to them.
And if they were in the proper condition when they read the book would tell them how to read it, tell them how to make sense of it. That's what Martin Luther really says about his discovery, as he felt it, that salvation comes by faith in God alone. He's reading, and suddenly he sees how to line up all of the significant texts in the Bible. So reading is complicated, it's contentious, it's a source of incredible arguments, and people die over these arguments in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Do you ever get envious about how people used to read back then? I mean, that it was such a powerful experience. That I don't think we can have that anymore.
So one of the people I study, Isaac Casaubon, a great 16th century scholar, tells us he would always comb his hair before he went upstairs to read. And then he would sit down in his study and he would pray. And only then would he open his books and read. So it's not necessarily a religious experience. He's often reading secular books, but there's a kind of religious intensity to what he's doing. And I actually found, as I began really getting into the history of books, and my first students started really getting into computers and programming, that I understood those students better. When a student would turn up at my office hours in pajamas with green skin because, you know, he or she had been, you know, in the computer lab for seven straight days coding something. That's the way people read in the 16th century. Now it's the new media and the new machines that attract that kind of total passionate engagement.
Well, do you think the experience of reading changes as the technology changes? I mean, if you're reading, I don't know, a handwritten manuscript as opposed to a printed book, as opposed to now, you know, reading on a screen.
Technology doesn't always change reading. But if you read on screen, there are a couple of things that are really quite worrying about it. One is that computer optimization people have worked out that if you use a camera and track the eye movements of someone reading on a computer screen, you don't actually look at the whole screen. You go across the top of the screen, you go down a bit, you make a sort of second cross movement that isn't long.
Then you're kind of skimming more.
Well, your eye moves in the shape of an F. When you read on screen. So what's on the bottom right, you just don't even see.
And this is different than reading on a printed
page? Yes, people don't do this reading on a printed page. You do this reading on a screen. If you're doing web design, you bear this in mind, and web designs often are F-shaped so that the stuff on the bottom right is the stuff that doesn't matter. Or they use really powerful visual elements to jerk you out of the F and call your attention to the part of the page that isn't in the F. But suppose you're reading a page of prose on screen. You're going to miss the bottom right. You're going to miss part at the top right and every page.
That's so interesting. I have to tell you that I've just noticed that I read differently on a screen versus on the printed page. And maybe this is just my own peculiarity. I know that I don't read as carefully if it's on a screen. I tend to skim. I'm the classic web surfer. I'm sort of trying to consume a lot of information quickly. And I'm a much more careful reader if it's a printed book.
It's absolutely true. We do know that any way you read wires your brain. If you learn to read Chinese, it wires one part of your brain. If you learn to read an alphabetic language, it wires a different part of your brain. And we can tell this from what lights up when you read. It's also possible to have a stroke if you're bilingual and lose your Western reading ability while keeping your Chinese reading ability,
really?
Or vice versa.
So does that mean a Chinese person has a different experience of reading than an American?
Probably, yes. But not when he's reading the same things that an American reads.
Huh.
So reading wires you. Reading scrolls must have wired us one way. Reading the Codex book must have wired us one way. And what we don't know is whether eventually we will adapt being the kinds of clever monkeys that we are to the point where we can read on screen as effectively as we read on paper.
Oh, fascinating history. Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Tony Grafton is a historian at Princeton University. He talked with Steve Paulson during a visit to the University of Wisconsin's Center for the Humanities.